had returned to this courtroom in August, and we've been holding oral arguments here, and we're testing out a sound system which has not always been satisfactory. So it's not counsel's fault, but sometimes you fade in and out. We may ask you to repeat a sentence. In addition to that, the audience here sometimes has trouble hearing counsel or hearing a justice. So if the student would raise his or her hand when he can't, when you can't hear someone, that's just going to help us in trying to figure out what we can do with the sound system. And I feel that I'm fading in and out periodically on certain words, but it's not clear to me why that happens, since from my perspective, my position is the same and my volume and speaking voice is the same, but I did hear myself fade in and out. So if you would raise your hand or do something to signify that, it might help us. So 00-0929, in the matter of the guardianship and protective placement of Muriel K., alleged incompetent, Jeffrey K. et al. Versus Milwaukee County. Representing Jeffrey and Norris Knight is Patricia M. Is it Cavey? Attorney Cavey, you may proceed.
Your Honor, I would like to reserve the maximum time for rebuttal.
You have, according to the schedule, 5 minutes. And Mr. Peregrine will have 20 minutes, and Mr. McGrath, 10. That's how they will divide up their 30 minutes. Okay?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Wisconsin citizens have the legal right to create power of attorney documents, durable power of attorney documents, and power of attorney documents for health care decisions. They have the legal right to designate who those agents or decision makers will be for them when they have a period of incapacity or at their pleasure no longer choose to handle financial matters or other matters. Healthcare decision making is typically triggered upon incapacity because we have the individual present for the healthcare decision, and then the law looks to that agent to as the guide, as the trusted person selected by the individual, by the principal. We expect that that person has been selected because they are trusted or because they have some special knowledge as to the wishes of the principal, what their wishes are in terms of end-of-life care, what their wishes are in terms of being able to live in their home or not wanting to be a burden on family and choosing to be in a nursing home or some other facility. But the law, the statutory law, creates this power. This court has also looked in terms of situations where people have not gotten around to do these power of attorney agents, power of attorney documents, as to what their wishes are in discerning what is in their best interest. And this court has said in the matter of the guardianship of LW that if we know, if we can discern from that individual what they wanted, what they directed, that is the best interest. So we start there with these legal rights and with the assumption that the chosen person has some special knowledge as to what wishes are. Muriel K. in this case hired a lawyer. She communicated her wishes to that lawyer, Attorney Moody, and her concerns regarding distant relatives who would, in her words, accuse her of not being in her right mind. She executed legal documents. She created a videotape to further communicate what her wishes were, why they are as they are, who she trusted, how she wanted to leave her estate, and who she had relationships with, who she saw on a daily basis, and who she didn't see, what people were not part of her life. Attorney Moody assisted her in developing this video for the specific purpose of responding to a letter by the distant relative to Attorney Moody outlining some of his concerns. Attorney Moody had that letter prior to drafting and executing the power of attorney documents with his client, Muriel Kay. Exactly what Muriel had feared and what she had expressed in this video happened in this case. Muriel's advance directives, her health care power, and her durable power of attorney were suspended at an ex parte hearing. She had no notice that the hearing was going to take up the issue of her power of attorney documents. Even though the power of attorney documents were appended to the petition and the documents were obtained from Attorney Moody was not provided notice of this hearing, nor were the power of attorney agents the Knights. Muriel was taken into custody in November, and this ex parte hearing was held, and was held without a placement order, contrary to Wisconsin law, Chapter 55, and this court's case, the matter of Agnes T., until March. And those people who she specifically chose to be the folks to make decisions for her were prevented from visiting her. Her attorney was barred from any kind of contact with her. What we're asking the court here today is to look at the power of attorney law in the state of Wisconsin and to tell the citizens of this state whether they truly have a right to these advance directives. Do they truly have a right to what the state bar's promotion called a life plan, to do these life planning documents? And if they have a right to do these things, and that right can't be enforced, is that then a meaningless right? And what this case, how this case procedurally comes to the court is on a question of standing. The Court of Appeals decided that, looking at a subsection of a statute, that the power of attorney agents do not have standing to bring these matters on appeal.
Counsel, the Muriel Kay could have named the Knights her guardian, right? Would that have helped us any?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because what the right is here is to have a right to an agent, and an agent has more power and more authority than a guardian does. And the type of planning that the term elder law has developed, the type of planning that we do is to advise people to avoid guardianships. Most people prefer to have their decisions kept out of the court system and to have things handled in a private way, that with under consultation with their lawyer, they can privately describe their situation, who the people that are in their lives, and come up with a life plan and reduce that to a legal document.
But the legislature has recognized that you might be right when you made it, but then things change. And so you're going to be incompetent when things change. And somehow the law has to protect you, right? So the law provides that the court can just overturn the carefully laid plans of the incompetent, the now incompetent. I don't mean to indicate that the court will do it willy-nilly or that the court doesn't take these things seriously, but here's an example where the court overturned the plans, right?
Correct. And I think that really is the issue. How lightly does one do this? And if these plans have any kind of legal significance, can a court can certainly revoke power of attorney documents. And if a power of attorney document does not provide for something that later becomes needed, guardianship is the forum where that is addressed. But the question is, can a court revoke and remove those choices from you, remove that legal right from you without notice, without the opportunity to have your chosen representatives come before the court and present that evidence to the court?
Well, I thought the issue was not what happened at the trial court, but and the merits thereof or the validity thereof, but the issue is who has the right to appeal, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it's a standing question.
Now, if your client doesn't have the right to appeal, and this is the Knights who have been named in these powers, right? If your client doesn't have the right to appeal and doesn't have standing, who is going to appeal in this case? Who has the right to have an appeal?
The statute that the Court of Appeals looked at was 879.27, and there are two subsections that need to be looked at and to be harmonized, 1 and 4. Section 1 talks about an aggrieved person. And Section 4 talks about the kind of the best interest concept of who may appeal on behalf of a minor or incompetent. Under Section 4, the statute says that it is only the guardian of the estate and the guardian ad litem. And the Court of Appeals read that to be exclusive, that one cannot be read with four. The problem with that reading is that it excludes the ward herself from appealing. It excludes the ward from having an attorney appeal on her behalf, and it excludes the agents. Those three entities are all covered under number one, an aggrieved person. Certainly there must be some finality. Someone must be aggrieved to get to an appellate level.
Now, counsel, we've got a guardian, right, of the estate. We've got a guardian ad litem. And we've got adversary counsel, right?
Correct.
And that is all, the fees for all these people and expenses are paid from the estate, correct?
They have been. There is some question as to whether they should be.
What about Mr. Knight's fees?
Mr. Knight's fees have not been paid from the estate. Mr. Knight's fees have been either paid by Mr. Knight or have been a pro bono representation on my part.
You think that someone who's aggrieved and an appeal should be paid from the estate?
I think the court needs to look at the terms of the document. Power of attorney document is a contract, and I think the beauty of it and why the right is so important to people in planning is that you can use that document to set forth the scope. If you want extreme protection, you would put in your document various things that you would want these people to conduct litigation on your behalf if someone ever sued you or needed to
be represented. Is that a standard clause?
Yes, it is. And it is a standard in the state form. The Knights, Attorney Moody, in drafting the document for Muriel K., did include a specific litigation clause in the document.
Counsel? 243.07 sub 3b allows that with regard to the durable power of attorney that a principal may nominate the agent who also be a guardian. Was that done here?
It was not specifically done. However, it is common practice that attorneys use this conduct litigation clause to handle that situation.
I mean, for instance, to me, maybe this whole case would be obviated if that provision existed in the durable power of attorney. 243.07.3b says principal may nominate by durable power of attorney, the guardian, so you can say, this is my agent under the durable power of attorney. If guardianship or protective placement is necessary, I want that agent to be appointed guardian. And then the statute goes on to say that the court has to act in accord with that desire set forth in the document, except for good cause or disqualification. So if the court says, hey, it's certainly contrary to the ward's best interest to have this person serve as a guardian, then, and the court makes those findings, then the court can remove that person. But absent that, if, as I understand the law, if that provision is set forth in the durable power of attorney, that agent becomes the guardian.
I don't think we would have a different case, Your Honor. That certainly is a provision by statute that people can include in their documents. Typically, what is included when attorneys craft these documents is a clause saying, we are doing this to avoid a guardianship, and we want our rights respected, but there isn't a specific naming of someone to serve as a guardian. That certainly is the language in the statute, and there is some provision for it in the state form. But typically what we are doing is we do power of attorney documents to avoid coming to court, to keep these things private. I don't think it would be a different case here given the allegations. I think we would be coming in and there would be these same allegations. The difference would be there would be an opportunity to respond to those.
That's right. And the difference would be, I don't know this, I'm positing this. The difference would be that you would have standing. Let's say this case had a document that said, I want my agent to be the guardian. And let's say the person then goes to court and there's a contested hearing and the court says, I know this is what the principal wanted, but it's not in the principal's best interest. And what then would be the posture for appeal with regard to that fact situation?
With all due respect, I don't see the difference, because they could either add that clause in the contract, or they could have paragraph 14, which they do have in the contract, and paragraph 1. And 1 and 14 say, I'm expressly granting to my agent any authority that I would have myself, and in particular, that includes litigation, to conduct litigation, to act in my place. And so I think that clause gets us into paragraph 1, sub 1 of the appeal statute 879-27. I think if we had in the contract that I am doing this document so you could take care of my financial matters and pay my bills for me, but that's as far as I want you to go, then they don't have standing. And so I think when we have these crafted documents, which people do have a right to draw up, we have to look at the terms of the document. And if the document provides for conducting litigation or serving in your place in that capacity, then we have agency law that tells us the agent stands in the shoes of. They are the aggrieved party. It isn't the four, sub four, on behalf of. They do represent the person, and we expect under this agency theory that there's been some communication and some knowledge between the principal and the agent. And that's why we have the agent standing in the shoes. And we look to the contract, and we're bound by the contract. It isn't a floodgates problem or a floodgates situation where if you let these people come in, you're going to have every neighbor and friend and whatever acquaintance coming to the court, interfering with these matters and appealing if they don't have full participation.
So the problem here is that the guardianship laws revoke the durable power of attorney, that that's part of the procedure?
Not necessarily. The guardianship law permits the revocation after a hearing, and our position is you cannot have a legal right to create these contracts if you can also be excluded from the hearing. The courts can certainly revoke, but the courts need to hear from the chosen person, especially when these things occur in guardianship, because in guardianship we have a petition that alleges incapacity, incompetency. So we have a situation where all these court-appointed best interest roles come in after incapacity. So we have a defendant who isn't as capable, if you know, in the best situation, a petition shouldn't be filed unless they are incapacitated. And then we have a situation where the defendant isn't as able to communicate to court-appointed counsel, to the best interest role of a guardian ad litem. And so we look at what was done before. And I think this court looked at that in both the guardianship of the LW and Edna MF. What did they do before? What were the statements of their wishes? And here we have two contracts, a videotape, a relationship with a lawyer, all excluded from the court proceedings because it was first done ex parte without notice, and then at the full trial in March, the agents were only permitted very limited standing to call one medical doctor. They were not permitted to testify as to Muriel's wishes. Trial court refused to look at Muriel's videotape. Trial court refused to hear from Muriel's chosen attorney, Attorney Moody. So what the court can certainly revoke, and the statutes provide for that, but there's a question of due process here. If the revocation occurs ex parte, where folks can come in and make some pretty serious allegations and not permit any kind of response, and we have a defendant who is now incapacitated and can't say, wait a minute, this is exactly what I feared. I knew this was going to happen. Didn't you see my videotape? I said, you know, these folks are going to come in and accuse me of not being in my right mind, and I want to do something about that. So can people plan? If you know that is something, a risk in your life, can you plan for that? Can you meet with your attorney, and based on what you and your attorney agree, you may have this conduct litigation clause to not open the door to guardianship litigation.
Counsel, I was just thinking that since she was advised by counsel, certainly you could have appointed the knights as guardian to give them that understanding, the powers under the statute, give them that power, that they would have had the power to, they could have had that power. That's one that...
There are two concerns with that. Number one, the statutory authority of a guardian is more limited than what a power of attorney agent is. So if Muriel loses her power of attorney documents, she does have a loss of rights. And power of attorney is not the same as a guardianship. An agent is not the same as a guardian.
I thought about that as you amplified the fact that she made a video to show what her wishes were and what others may do, and that's why I thought that if that was to be that explicit and she was that concerned, that that was certainly an option that she had rather than resting simply with the durable power of attorney.
That's right, Your Honor, and she did take that extra step of not only hiring an attorney, not just using the statutory form, which there is a form in the statutes both for the durable and for the health care where you can check off some boxes as to what your wishes are. She did hire a lawyer, and they did this over a period of time. One document was signed in June, the video was September 2nd, the other document was some other time in later September. So these weren't all, you know, run in and quick sign something. She had time to think about things, talk to her lawyer, and they had time to make some decisions as to how they were going to present this. It is very common, and we do have an affidavit in the record as part of an offer of proof of Attorney Pat Nelson, an elder lawyer, stating that we routinely advise people that we do these things to avoid guardianship, and we don't want to say, well, and now when we have the guardianship hearing, then we want this, that, and the other thing. Because the point of doing these documents is people don't want to go to court. They want to have their things handled privately. Muriel desperately did not want these people involved in her personal business. And when we come to court, that's exactly where everybody is. They're getting medical reports, they're reviewing people's medical records and things, and she's a very private woman, as many people are, and they do these things in consultation with their lawyers to keep your planning personal, that it doesn't have to be part of a court record, that a lot of times people don't even know about these things, where you may appoint someone as your agent and just have you and your attorney hold on to these documents until the right time comes, and then people are told. So,
I don't think anybody disagrees that these documents serve a purpose outside of guardianship and that one of their purposes is to avoid formal court guardianship procedures. The question in this case is, how do you make them stick if there is a formal institution of a guardianship and protective placement proceedings in court? And the statutes specifically say that a healthcare power of attorney agent and financial durable power of attorney agent are subordinate to any court-appointed guardian. So it seems to me, reading the statutes all together, if you want these elections of who is going to speak for you and make decisions for you and conduct litigation for you, et cetera, over these matters, if you want to make that stick in a formal guardianship procedure, you've got to also, not in lieu of, but also in addition, designate who you want to serve your guardian, because that's what has presumptive force once a guardianship is initiated.
And with all due respect, I think that is a very narrow reading of the right to delegate the ability to conduct litigation and act in your place. I understand that, yes, the guardianship statutes do enumerate, you can do these various things, but they don't say that if you have this broader, more encompassing paragraph to delegate all authority you would have and to conduct litigation. I mean, that's a pretty serious thing, to delegate all that decision-making power to another individual. That guardianship is litigation. And why is that different, especially when these are the chosen people? I mean, it would be just these people and their authority kicks in, so to speak, upon incapacity.
Well, it's different because the statutes say it's different.
I think the statute gives you the option to do that. I don't think it is preclusive.
Well, let's go ahead, Justice Brasser.
There are two uniform laws at play here. What does the law in other states interpreting that uniform statute have to contribute to the dispute in this case?
Every state in this country adopted some form of power of attorney document by the late 1980s. Wisconsin had the durable in 81 and the health care power by, I believe, 1989. Recently, the Supreme Court in the state of California, in the case called Wendland, looked at when we have the difference between the chosen representative, between the situation where you select who you want to make decisions, where you've communicated those things, and the power of the state to appoint someone to make those decisions for you. And it gives great weight to the person's right to make these decisions for yourself, and that is above and beyond what the statutory rights are, that a court, certainly in a guardianship forum, can act to protect an individual, can appoint people to serve in that best interest role. But the court discusses that when we get to that point, we have people who have often lost capacity and are not in the same place as they were when they communicated things to their agent. So they take great care in looking to that individual to inform the court as to what the wishes were, and not what someone who has just met the individual. In this case, it is very troubling that Muriel had an attorney appointed to represent her, not a best interest concept, but what's called adversary or advocate counsel. And that attorney met with Muriel one time, February 17th, in the entire course of these proceedings, one time, and then purports to speak for her, represent what might be best for her, and indeed there were considerable costs in this case, costs for various best interest representation when she had hired an attorney who she had worked with for many months as to why exactly she had concerns and what they should do about that, and to select agents who saw her on a daily basis and who were her friends, as opposed to people who she did not trust and who the record reflects saw her maybe twice in the last 3 years. I see that my time is up.
One question. Would the appeal be? What is the standing to object to the appointment of the guardian or to object to the termination of the durable powers?
In this case, it's both. I think the right is that right to keep the power of attorney documents because you have more rights under those documents.
Who terminated them? Appointed guardian or the court?
At the ex parte hearing, the court commissioner suspended them, and that temporary guardian who was appointed then a few months later revoked them, and then in March the trial court judge affirmed that revocation and had a permanent guardianship and protective placement.
We have a circuit court order here terminating these.
That is correct.
Now if I could just summarize your case, maybe I'm wrong. Subsection, you're not coming in under subsection 4. If that's exclusive. Under subsection 1, you view the knights as aggrieved persons, either because they represent the board or they are the attorneys, in fact, or the agents. Is that your argument of standing in a nutshell?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Cavey. Are you prepared, Rick?
Thank you, Your Honor, members of the court. First, I wish to clarify the status of the record at the commencement of these proceedings. Muriel Kay was found to be severely incapacitated by the Milwaukee County Department on Aging and was promptly, after looked at by a doctor on the subsequent day, transported to Frederick Hospital in a life-saving effort. A petition for emergency guardianship was then promptly filed by Milwaukee County. Section 88015 S provides that notice need be given only to a proposed ward. Notice was given. The hearing was held, and as Ms. Cavey indicated, the powers of attorney were suspended. It's not an ex parte order. There never was an ex-party hearing in this case.
Was any notice given to the ward that powers of attorney would be subject to that hearing and possible suspension could occur?
Probably not, Your Honor. I was not involved in the case when that was done. I only gleaned the same thing from the record. But if the petition was given to the proposed ward, then the answer would be yes.
Well,
but that's a discretionary act by the probate court commissioner.
Even if you're right, as you were arguing on the issue of ex parte, and I'm not sure if you're right or not, but one of my concerns raised in the brief was that the principal of the board is given a notice of rights, but nowhere in the notice of rights is there any indication that the power of attorney could subject to revocation at the hearing that she's being given a notice about. Is that a problem?
I don't believe that's a problem, Your Honor. The statutes do not provide that you give a notice to the proposed incompetent on everything? Just the notice of the hearing, an emergency hearing for an emergency appointment of a guardian in a life-saving effort?
Isn't there a notice of rights? I might be wrong.
There's a notice of rights that the guardian ad litem provides under 880.33 at the time that the court considers incompetency. In any event, the powers of attorney that were suspended and were later revoked by the temporary guardian.
Now, were the Knights given notice and an opportunity to be heard?
The Knights were given notice of every hearing in this case except the first petition for emergency guardianship, and they were not required to be given a notice. I think that's clear that these are very important matters when life and death is involved. But now let me get to the very narrow issue of who can appeal from a order finding incompetency, appointing a guardian, or ordering protective placement. It's statutory. We have 879.27(1) and 879.27(4). (4) relates to appeals on behalf of an incompetent. (1) relate to appeals by an aggrieved person, i.e. a ward. It's well settled in this state that in order to be an appellant, you need to be aggrieved directly and injuriously. McLaughlin and Sanborn, 100 years ago, affirmed that. This court has pronounced that philosophy on all appellants, and nowhere have we heard anything about power of attorney agents being aggrieved as we define aggrieved.
Of course, the whole durable power is contrary to common law, isn't it? In common law, if the person became incompetent, the power of attorney ended, right?
That was the real problem that we in the bar had before we had the durable attorney, this big gray area when incompetent
decisions. Right. Well, how good are the old cases?
Oh, I think they're good. I think they're good, Your Honor.
Even though the whole concept of durable powers is just turned over.
The protection. Let's just slip a little bit into choices that people have. In order to have valid choices, you have to follow Wisconsin law. You have to have a durable power of attorney prepared and nominate a guardian, should there be a necessity for guardianship.
Let's suppose you had nominated a guardian. Now you get to court and we have the same process as here. Would the named guardian get notice?
If the name... Well, the notice is not an issue here, yes. I would give the name guardian.
Now, do you think the court can... on what grounds could the court decide, circuit court decide to name a different guardian? Statute says good cause, right?
That's right. There was no nomination in this
right.
case.
But if there had been, it would have been good cause.
There would have to be a hearing if there would be an objection to the nominated guardian.
You think there was good cause shown here in this case? Had there been a nominated guardian?
Well, yes, I do.
I thought you'd answer it that way.
I do.
So if there's a good cause and the court then knocked out the guardian, would that guardian have a right to appeal? Is the guardian an agreeing person?
The guardian? The nominated
guardian? Nominated guardian, right.
No.
That
under existing statutes,
right,
and case law, that nominee, now that guardian would have other rights, though, in the trial court to apply for a petition for reconsideration, to, as one of the cases said, raise the interest of the county court to do its job to make inquiries. Costin went through a number of things that interested parties have a right to do, but the legislature has restricted who can appeal.
So, and you have to have answered my question that way, I think, Mr. Peregrine, in order to answer the question in this case in the same way. I mean, that's the way I thought through this issue, and I think you did too. Then my next question is, who is the same question I asked your opposing counsel, who has the right here to challenge the circuit court's proceedings? The new guardian isn't. Is there not aggrieved? The adversary counsel who raised this issue and won isn't going to appeal. The ward is not going to appeal because the ward is incompetent and therefore is going to have very great difficulty doing that without counsel, right? So who's going to appeal? Who is going to make sure that there was no error here? And how does that fit with the Constitution, which gives a right of appeal in cases?
First of all, in answering the question, let me just recite for the court how adversarial counsel usually gets appointed. Usually, petition for guardianship is filed. The guardian ad litem visits the proposed ward. The proposed ward says, I want to oppose this. Immediately, the court appoints adversarial counsel. That's not how it happened in this case. Muriel K. did not wish to contest the guardianship. And she indicated to me that she wanted to contest the guardianship. I would have been duty-bound as her counsel to represent her wishes. You should also know that before this brief in this court was filed, I visited with her because I felt it was my responsibility to advocate her wishes. And I'm standing here today representing her and advocating her wishes in this case. She did not want to appeal under sub 1.
Let's say she had.
Well, I would have had to abandon this appeal. This is my client.
But let's say she had elected to appeal.
Elected?
Would you have standing as her adversary counsel?
Yes, under sub 1, because she would have been aggrieved because she didn't want to have guardian appointed.
Okay, and that's pursuant to what?
I can't hear you.
That's pursuant to what case law? It says the advocacy or adversary counsel is an aggrieved person under 877 sub 1.
Oh, I think in Tamara there's that discussion of the responsibility of counsel, adversarial counsel. You have to represent your client.
Okay, I'm sorry. The case again?
Tamara, C-A-M-A-R-A.
Counsel, of course, the facts in this case vary, but we are in a very important case here today, establishing the rights for all cases that would raise the question of who has the right to appeal. I'm concerned about rights given without remedies, and I'm concerned about the constitutional right to appeal. Those two things. 8033(3) says any interested person may at any time petition the court requesting a restoration of legal rights. Now, arguably it's interpreted that the Knights requested restoration or recognition of the principal's legal rights. For instance, they said, look, you can only extend this 30 days once, and we have done it more. Arguably, we're right. Do not have a temporary protective placement extended was violated and was inconsistent with Wisconsin law, arguably. Let's say it was. Can that right and violation of that right, is there any remedy for that? Is there anyone who can appeal that violation? Can an interested person who can bring the petition and ask the court to recognize that right, is there any redress for a violation of that?
Sure there is. First of all, what does the proposed board want? That's the first question. And that's where adversarial counsel comes in. Because if the proposed award is aggrieved after a petition for restoration of rights is made, then the award can appeal under sub 1.
Doesn't that beg the question, what does the proposed award want? I mean, in many situations, the proposed award is not capable at that stage of telling anyone what the issue is.
Well, there are ways that you... Your best judgment when you counsel with people with disabilities, Your Honor.
Oh, I know, but having handled many 880 cases, the condition of the wards just go the full gamut, and a lot of the wards are not capable of communicating their desires. And of course, the law that we interpret and apply here covers them as well as the ones that are... So when a ward has a due process violation and an interested person, that's a clear, let's say arguably, it's a clear violation of a statutory right, and an interested person brings that to the attention to the court and nothing is done about it, where is the remedy? Who has the right to appeal that?
Under the existing statutes, the guardian ad litem.
But if the guardian ad litem is going along with it, then that person
will
do it.
Guardian ad litem or the guardian of the estate. In my experience, our system does work.
Well,
it does work. Getting back to choices, if...
Let me ask, would the person, the interested person who brought this due process violation to the attention of the court with a petition under 880.33(3) have standing to appeal?
Not under the existing statutes, Your Honor. That's the answer, no. And we've had this law and this precedent for over 100 years. You know that a president principal could make four or five durable powers of attorney. Give one to a good friend, one to a child who lives in California, one to someone else. There's a real problem with how you regulate, how you get the notice. It just so happens that we had the notice here through the county that there was a power of attorney, but they're not filed anywhere. And if the power of attorney does not contain the nomination, so that that agent has a right to be a part of the entire guardianship proceeding, unless they are shown to not be qualified or not suitable, that's the way to solve that problem.
But it's not the way to solve this problem, because had she nominated, then we would still be faced with the question of do they have standing to appeal, and your answer would be no if they were removed.
That would be my answer, yes. That's the status of the... If you, have I answered your question?
Yes, sir. Justice Prosser had a question.
Finally, I want to say one thing about Carla. The Carla case, which was rendered by the Court of Appeals approximately the same time that the Court of Appeals rendered the decision in this case. And the two cases are in sync. Carla was an heir. Carla objected. Carla appealed, and Carla appealed under 879.27(1) because she was aggrieved. I think in order to get to any change in the existing law that we have, you need to deal with what rights a power of attorney agent acquires when the principal signs the document. The principal can revoke it. The agent cannot say, hey, wait a minute. Can't be done. If there's a guardian, the guardian can revoke it. And that's one way of preventing abuses. There are abuses in all systems that we have, but having the right to revoke it creates no personal right in the power of attorney agent.
You prevail, counsel. How is your how will the decision here fit in the interpretation of the uniform laws nationally?
I think it'll be in sync, Your Honor. Our right to appeal statutes have been in existence for 400 years, and the case
the law, uniform laws have not, however.
Well, I understand that, but the in order to appeal, you have to be aggrieved, and a power of attorney agent is not aggrieved person. A power of attorney document is an enabling document. Agent doesn't even have to act. There's not a requirement. The agent could refuse and say, I'm not going to be this attorney, in fact. I just had a heart attack. I can't do it. I'm sorry.
Well, the party can be, the ward can be aggrieved. Under the durable health powers, suppose the ward becomes terribly ill, and there's a question of what life-saving measures should or should not be performed, right?
Yes.
Under the durable power under the durable health care power, the person can say on behalf of the ward what measures should be taken, right? And they may say, Ward and I discussed it, didn't want any extraordinary measures. The guardian, on the other hand, can say, do whatever you have to do. Right?
The guardian could say that.
Yeah, could say something else.
The guardian saw the POA, the healthcare POA, he could or she could follow that mandate. Yeah.
But you have you have the possibility of two different decisions. Right?
Right.
So it seems to me, in light of that, that the ward, and the Count Miss Cavey Spitz said it somewhat differently, said that the powers of the guardian versus the power of the agent are different. The ward's wishes, at least as expressed to the agent, are not being fulfilled. Therefore, the ward is an aggrieved party. You agree with that?
Yes. Not the agent.
Okay. But the ward, by definition here, has been declared incompetent by clear and convincing evidence, right?
In this case, yes.
So how can this ward exercise her rights as an aggrieved party when she's incompetent?
She can express her understanding of the rights of the guardian ad litem, which must be appointed, and that guardian ad litem then should alert the court to appoint adversarial counsel, who then represents the ward and her wishes.
What if she's comatose?
Well, that's...
You have the same dispute outlined by the Chief Justice between the court-appointed guardian and the healthcare power of attorney agent.
I couldn't hear you.
The scenario is a dispute about a prearranged directive about prolonged care or extraordinary measures or something of that nature. And you've got a dispute about that between the agent appointed under the healthcare power of attorney, which, let's say, has not been suspended, but I guess I can't envision a situation where that would be the case, but let's say that's still in effect, and the court-appointed guardian. You've got a dispute about that. The ward is comatose, cannot communicate. Who speaks for the ward?
Guardian. Under existing law, the guardian speaks. And remember, in this case...
Even if the guardian is taking action that is explicitly contrary to the expressed wishes in the document.
Guardian can trump the attorney in fact.
As the statutes currently exist.
When a guardian is appointed, the health care POA is revoked. The durable could remain in place. But remember, there were health care powers of attorney here running to the nights. And... the ward, in this case, had to be transmitted to a hospital after calling 911 and was there for 16 days. That had probably something to do with some of the proceedings in this case before I was appointed by Judge Mannion.
Thank you, Mr. Peregrine.
You're welcome.
Now hear from Attorney McGrath, representing Stephen Underwood, the guardian of the person.
Yes, may it please the court, my name is Brian McGrath, I represent Stephen Underwood. I would like to tackle, I think, a previous question posed by the Chief Justice and a similar question posed by Justice Bradley with a little bit of a different spin. I sense some dissatisfaction, at least by those two justices, with the potential result, and I want to try to explain why all of this is good public policy. The Wisconsin statutes, as we currently confront them, have a hierarchy where the guardianship statutes trump the power of attorney statute. unless, and the legislature has deemed that it be so. And so we are faced with a situation where you could have somebody who has been given a power of attorney for health care, for finances, potentially even nominated as a guardian, and the trial court could determine that, that some other result would obtain. What happens then, the justices ask, and how is the incompetent protected? The system says that the incompetent is protected in a variety of ways. First, of course, the incompetent is protected by the trial court. Second, the incompetent is protected by the appointment of a guardian ad litem, who is a distant, disinterested attorney, who's got no prior interest with respect to that person's affairs, who is empowered by the state to protect that individual. In this case, the individual is also protected by a guardian of the estate, who was her longtime attorney, John Rush.
Yes. McGrath, again, this is a sound issue, so I wonder if you could raise the podium to see if that will help us any. And when Ms. Cavey comes, I'm going to ask you to lower the podium.
All right.
Is that comfortable enough for you? Okay.
All right. So in this particular case, Muriel was also protected by a guardian of the estate, her longtime attorney, John Rush. In addition, Muriel was protected by Attorney Peregrine, adversary counsel, so that if there was some transgression of her rights, those attorneys all had the right to protect her rights and all had the right to appeal on her behalf if there was some violation of her rights. The question this court has to answer is, all right, but in the rest of the world, is there anybody else who can appeal if there's determined to be or thought to be some violation of her rights? If there's some sort of appeal, participation in the trial court is one issue, because there are some people who have some rights, as you've pointed out, Justice Bradley, to bring things to the attention of the trial court under 880.33. But the separate question is, of all the rest of the people in the world, whether it's an adult child, whether it's a best friend, whether it's a next-door neighbor, or whether it's a power of attorney agent, as a matter of statute, as the legislature said, and would be, and might it be a good idea for them to say that all of those people can file that appeal as well? And I think the answer to that is that would be bad public policy, and that's what I think the court said in Sanborn way back when, because the incompetent has an estate to protect as well. And
now,
yes?
If I may, when you spoke of Sanborn way back when, that's one of my problems that I need your help to address, because the way back when and counsel's comments about the definition of a grieved party goes back 100 years or something like that, and indeed the Court of Appeals opinions relied upon are of 100-year vintage. I'm concerned that our common law and our statutory law has not kept pace with today's realities, which include legislation authorizing and promoting durable powers of attorney for health care and financial reasons. And to the extent that the legislature hasn't kept pace, that's their problem. I mean, that's their bailiwick. But to the extent that common law or issues have arisen under the common law because of this dissonance, I have a problem. So the response of it's been this way for 100 years, well, durable power of attorneys haven't been in existence for 100 years. Let me give you a hypothetical, and I don't know if this will be of assistance. Let's say I can afford a good attorney, and I got a great attorney, and he does all this durable power of attorneys things and for health care, and it's like a class act document. It does not, however, provide that my agent will continue on as guardian. Okay? And let's say I'm 65 years old, and my husband is deceased, and I fall in love with this guy, and we live together for 20 years, and I make him, and I He is my life. And I make him my agent under my durable power attorney for health care, because he knows better than anyone, better than my kids, better than my friends, better than my relatives. He knows what I want. And now I'm in a situation where I'm losing my competency. And one of my children, who hasn't been particularly dutiful, I haven't seen in years and years, petitions the court for a guardianship. You know, I wouldn't like it if this guy who was my life for 20 years, who I wanted everything to go to, I wouldn't like it if the court would say, okay, we're going to make your child or your niece or your nephew now your guardian and displace everything that I had planned. How can you respond to that? Because I think that is the reality of lots of people.
I would respond, Judge, by just changing the hypothetical slightly to say, and what if you had told all the world that you wanted the same person to inherit all your earthly goods, but didn't make out a will? The state of Wisconsin would say that despite what you may have said that you wanted, you have to follow the statutes to accomplish that result. And the way to follow the statutes to leave that person your earthly possession is to make out a proper will. And the way to have that person govern your affair is to nominate him as guardian. And if you don't do that, then the state is not necessarily going to honor what you might otherwise say were your choices.
So my decision for health care and the way that I want to be attended to in my dying days will be given no accord.
Well, it again depends upon what you have done in terms of preparing proper legal documents, but the legislature has said that once you become incompetent, the health care power of attorney, a guardian has pointed, the health care power of attorney is automatically revoked.
Isn't that the public policy we're talking about then? There is an obligation on this wonderful person that wants to do these things to make sure that they're done legally. So the public policy is, if we have this so-called right to appeal, that certainly you'd have to have some legal firmness, and that would be to comply with the law. And that's the public policy.
Yes, sir. And I think it's why the legislature has limited who can appeal on behalf of the guardian, and it's not your best friend, and it's not necessarily your children. It's the individuals identified in 879.27 sub 4, and the incompetent himself or herself under sub 1, because otherwise everybody else in the world could have the right to put your estate through continuous litigation. You might have, you know, my mother had 8 children, and we might have had differences of opinion as to what was in her best interest. Could each of us come in and file litigation in the trial court and then appeal and burden her estate on a regular basis? The legislature has said no, that we are going to protect the interests of the incompetent in a variety of ways, and we're going to designate those people who, as a matter of public policy, will protect her interests, and power of attorney agents aren't on that list. So, Muriel Kay has the right to make life choices like the rest of us, but when she makes those life choices, she has to make them, if she wants them to be followed, to make them in a way indicated by the Wisconsin legislature. And in this case, it would have been to nominate the Knights as guardians if that was the life choice that she wanted, if she wanted them to participate in the guardianship proceedings. And Justice Prosser has asked about uniform laws. The only cases we found under the uniform statutes were the Massachusetts and the Pennsylvania cases cited in my brief, and those cases say that had she nominated them as guardian, that they would have had the right to proceed to full participation in the trial court proceeding on guardianship. I submit, in response to Justice Abrahamson's question, that they might not have had the right to appeal, because in addition to having the Uniform Act, Wisconsin also has 879.27 sub 4, which may be different from state to state and may change from other states who has the right to appeal. But in following the Uniform Act, had she done that, then Judge Mannion would have had to allow them to participate in the trial court proceedings in a full and complete manner. That had been her life choice. So I think that the public policy of the state is sensible and expressed by the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Ms. Cavey?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm getting taller. I wanted to be real tall.
Drop it down a bit more. I know that it was high before. I'm merely testing.
Okay. Is this?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. I'd like to start first with just spending a couple of seconds on these allegations. And I just simply want to say they're throughout the briefs, and they're very disturbing. And I would like to say what occurred at trial was the petitioning attorney, Milwaukee County, at record site 74, page 47, that's the transcript, that she stated, "We are not here to prove these allegations," and then no evidence went in. There was evidence submitted as part of an offer of proof that there was a registered nurse who was part of the care team hired by the Knights on duty the day that this county caseworker came over to the house. That registered nurse certainly has an obligation as a mandatory reporter under state statute, if there was something horrid going on, to report elder abuse. In the record is a letter from Attorney Moody to both the county caseworker and to Mr. Underwood that he does understand people are making these allegations. He has checked them out, and there is no basis for them. And the other site I would like to refer the court to is an affidavit by a friend of Muriel's, Carlene Cavalaris, who the record site to that is 64 at page 7. Ms. Cavalaris was at the house the day before Muriel was placed into custody and also saw her at the nursing home after she was taken into custody. And Ms. Cavalaris states in her affidavit that Muriel was much better at home, in a much better condition than the person she witnessed at the nursing home. Certainly there's a lot of trauma that occurs when somebody's taken into custody, placed in a hospital, and I submit that perhaps what some people saw was the after effect of taking someone out of their home by force and putting them in custody. But I think it was worth mentioning because these are disturbing allegations and the Knights never had a chance to respond to them. And in fact, the alleger stated that they're not even going to bother to prove these things, and yet they keep continuing to show up in the briefs.
So could I ask, Mr. Peregrin, represented here, I have talked with the ward, and I am following the ward's wishes. You dispute that?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, and I want to refer the court to two different sites in the record. A report by the medical doctor, Dr. Kim Peterson, who's the medical doctor here in Madison, a geriatric doctor, at 64, page 11. And Dr. Peterson evaluated Muriel on the hearing was on a Monday in March, I believe it was March 6th, and he evaluated her that Friday. And she explained to him what her position was. And also, again, to the Carlene Cavalaris affidavit at 64, page 7. And there is something that Muriel does. Muriel's in daily phone contact with my clients. She will ask, as Dr. Peterson says in his report, the first thing out of her mouth was, "Who sent you?" And Dr. Peterson explained that he was hired by me and that I represented the Knights, and he was there to do a report that would not be confidential and that would be used in a court proceeding. and Muriel express them candidly. And I think that is the difference between the reports we see from the county psychologist, Dr. Sherry, when he goes in. Does Muriel perceive this person to be there as the expert for the prosecution? Who are these people? Mr. Peregrin, the evidence of his meeting with Muriel is in his bill, which is in the record. There is one meeting. How does Muriel post, you know, if she is incapacitated, which Dr. Peterson says when he met with her, she was fully competent, she had no medical need to be in a nursing home, and there was no physical reason that she couldn't have been in court. So how does that person, and because we never hear from Muriel, and I think that's the importance of the Simmons case. Court really needs to hear these folks. Otherwise, we have everybody talking for her, and we don't hear from her. And oddly enough, in this case, the people she hired and designated, we don't hear from them either. But the people who Muriel understood were coming in as potential witnesses to oppose the guardianship, to oppose these people being appointed for guardian. They saw an entirely different person. Dr. Peterson concludes she has capacity. Sherry says not, that she's totally confused. He had to have two meetings with her in February because she terminated the meeting. And at one point he indicates that she does not know the date of her birth even and comes up with those conclusions. We see in her videotape that she does with Attorney Moody that Muriel never tells anyone the date of her birth. So does she not know, or is she just not going to answer that question? And a person who sees somebody either post capacity or an elderly person who you don't know, who do they know that you are, and how candid are they going to feel they can be to you and to answer your questions? If they see you as, you know, just another arm of the prosecution, maybe she's not going to cooperate. And I think Ms. Cavalaris goes through that in her affidavit. The person she knows to be Muriel and what she saw November 2nd and what she saw in the nursing home and then what Muriel was able to explain to her that she understood what was going on. My clients actually found out that this court accepted the petition for review for Muriel. Muriel contacted them before I had a chance to. So she is very much aware of what's going on. And I think we just have, unfortunately, this different perception, probably because of the roles people serve, that this best interest function is something that people can't fairly suspect, because if you are informed, you know that job may not be what you want. They may not be following your direction.
Ms. Cavey, thank you.
Sorry, Your Honor.
That's all right. I want to thank Ms. Cavey and Ms. McGrath and Mr. Peregrin for the argument here today. We will now close.